and welcome to the SAGE podcast of Critical Sociology's Labor Scholar Series. I'm Graham Cassano, Culture and Media Editor for Critical Sociology. Chris Romberg is Associate Professor of Sociology at Fordham University. He is the author of The Broken Table, The Detroit Newspaper Strike and the State of American Labor. Recently, Professor Romberg and I had the opportunity to talk about his work on the Detroit newspaper strike of the late 1990s. We began with Professor Romberg's concept of the signal juncture.
Once institutions begin to develop along a particular path, they tend to stay on that path until a radical break or quote-unquote critical juncture occurs. But this doesn't give us a good way to analyze conflicts that occur within paths or historical periods. Unlike a critical juncture, the signal juncture captures the internal tensions and conflicts that persist within periods, even when they do not result in a dramatic turning point. In other words, critical juncture happens at the beginning or end of a path or period, while a signal juncture happens in the middle of the path and signals the new terrain of struggle.
How would you describe the post-World War II capital-labor relation in the United States?
Employers in the United States have always taken a very resistant attitude towards unions, but historians argue that the post-World War II era labor and management developed what they call a kind of accord. In sectors that were already unionized, collective bargaining stabilized under the system established by the National Labor Relations Act. You know, instead of having conflict all the time, you had strikes between contracts and then disputes on the job channeled into grievance arbitration.
Explain the end of this accord and the rise of the anti-union regime of the late 20th century.
The rise of the anti-union regime in current American labor relations really began in the 1980s. The symbolic turning point for that was the 1981 PATCO strike of the air traffic controllers, in which President Ronald Reagan fired them for striking. The air traffic controllers were federal government employees, and Reagan's decision didn't have a direct effect on the private sector. But it announced a change in federal government policy, and following that lead, employers took a much more aggressive stance in efforts to break strikes and eliminate unions. Well, the Detroit strike then occurs within a series of explosive conflicts within different industries and different sectors and regions of the country. After the strikes of the 1980s and early 90s, American unions developed at least two counter strategies. First, although the law permits replacement of quote-unquote economic strikers seeking better wages and working conditions, it forbids the replacement of workers who strike against employers' unfair labor practices. Such strikers are entitled to reinstatement when they end their strike, and employers who refuse to take them back may be liable for back pay. Another more highly public counter-strategy went beyond the simple work stoppage and aimed at mobilizing support from the surrounding community, which takes advantage of geographic union density and gains resources from the fabric of local civil society. Both of these strategies were in play in the Detroit newspaper strike.
What happened during the Detroit newspaper strike of the 1990s?
In Detroit, the newspaper strike included some 2,500 workers, including journalists, printers, press operators, circulation workers, janitors, and Teamster truck drivers. The strike itself lasted for 19 months. At that point, then, the workers made an unconditional offer to return to work, but the employer refused to take them back or displace the permanent replacements to allow them to return. At that point, the strike became a lockout pending the determination of the unfair labor practices case. The unions won their case and the decision by the administrative law judge in 1997. In 1998, the full National Labor Relations Board in Washington, D.C. upheld the claim that the strike was caused by unfair labor practices. Okay. But the employers appealed the decision to the federal courts. And in 2000, the federal appeals courts struck down the unfair labor practices decision, in effect costing the unions their legal rights.
Who owned the newspapers?
The news was owned by the Gannett Company, which was the largest newspaper chain in the nation. And the Free Press was owned by Knight Ridder, which at that time was the second largest newspaper chain. Between the two of them, they had a joint operating agreement, which meant that they combined their business operations. Well, the joint operating agency was governed by a board which was dominated by Gannett. Right. And Gannett, in particular, epitomized the lean and mean style of corporate organization that gained prominence in the 1980s. Gannett operated about 80% non-union throughout the chain, and they were determined to bring cost in Detroit down to the level of their other newspaper. So there was really a conflict here between two different industrial models. The unions fought to defend New Deal principles of collective bargaining, while Gannett in particular then wanted to achieve structural changes along the lines of the anti-union corporate model. Well, the unions not only pursued the unfair labor practices case, but they also mobilized significant support in the community in the union town of Detroit. So they carried on both a circulation and an advertising boycott. They succeeded, actually, the enormous support, they succeeded in reducing circulation by at least a third. The companies admitted to losing $92 million in the first 6 months. The newspapers in this case were owned by national chains that had enormous resources. So they were able to afford to absorb the losses in Detroit and await the outcome of a legal decision in the federal courts. When the unions lost their unfair labor practice case, they lost their last legal leverage. And in the end, the unions finally agreed to contracts in December of 2000, largely on management terms.
What are some of the implications of your study?
More than any particular tactic, I think for unions, the key is that the conflict now extends across multiple arenas and requires comprehensive strategic planning. The large corporations have more resources to resist workers in local workplaces and communities. Unions have to reach out to a larger public, but that includes building alliances with groups that have not always had access to traditional unionization. Technical or economic issues of bargaining need to be understood in broader terms of cultural standards of decency and democratic rights. The specific mix of tactics and strategies will depend on the case. But the point is that the conflict is no longer operates within well-defined channels. Right? That it extends across multiple arenas in the local community, even the global economy, and in the legal system.
What are some of the implications of your study for the state of American labor?
We have to understand that the rules of the game have changed. We've returned to a pre-New Deal era. Before the National Labor Relations Act, historians described the legal situation that unions faced as one of quote-unquote judicial repression. Laws generally prohibited collective action by workers. In the current era, while the government no longer typically sends in troops, legal limitations now have basically limited the right to strike, have eliminated the right to strike. At the bargaining table, the ease of permanent replacement of strikers dovetails with legal rules that allow employers unilaterally to implement their last offer upon declaration of impasse. An employer could now demand deed concessions that were predictably unacceptable to the union and then simply decline to move from its position. Hence, the previous mechanisms that once encouraged settlement were now reversed. Employers gained incentives to reach impasse quickly and terminate bargaining, while unions often scrambled to find ways to prolong negotiations in order to stave off impasse. Even profitable employers soon began to demand steep concessions, in effect daring workers to strike, knowing that the outcome might easily lead to displacing the union. Rather than the two parties moving incrementally towards each other, employers come in with their most extreme demands and then can simply refuse to move from their position. The union then has a dilemma: either accept the terms or go on strike and risk permanent replacement or other consequences. We don't really have a legally protected right to strike in this country anymore. So we need to get that back. So the struggle not only occurs within the community and in economic terms, in particular strikes, but it also means that we need to change the rules of the game. The decline of unions has directly contributed to the rise of inequality in the United States and the stagnation of earning power and incomes for the majority of the working population.
Thank you to Associate Professor Chris Romberg.
Thanks to Roz Hartigan for engineering and production.
This podcast series was made possible in part through a grant from Wayne State University. I'm Graham Cassano, culture and media editor for Critical Sociology. Critical Sociology is a quarterly journal published by Sage. For more information, please visit our website, crs.sagepub.com.